Hello there, my name is Chris Kirk and welcome to TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. We are at Edinburgh Festival 2023. I have set myself up in a little room just next to the Bristow Square, George Square hub of the fringe, and I am grabbing a load of people who are performing at the festival this year to talk past, present and future, the story so far, this year's show and what's happening next. Today, Sophie Zucker, writer, performer, comedian, who you may have seen in the Apple TV series Dickinson. She's also part of the writing team on The Daily Show and has had a long career in stand-up and performing comedy. And she's here at the Edinburgh Festival this year with a show at Underbelly Bristow Square called Sophie Sucks Face. I wanted to find out more, past, present and future. So let's get TW talking with Sophie Zucker. So we're here now with our next interview at Edinburgh Festival 2023. I'm joined by Sophie Zucker. Thank you for joining us for this chat. Oh my God.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to be talking about your show in a bit, but we are, what, 6 days in now as we're recording this?
Yes, we are.
It'll be a little bit further by the time it goes out, but it's 6 days in as we record this. So I always like to start off by asking people, how is your fringe going so far?
It's actually been really, really great. You know, aside from the part that I am losing my voice, but I knew that was gonna happen. I'm honestly, it's not even from doing my show, it's from going out afterwards and like screaming in the bars, you know? So that I just have to like, you know, roll that back a little bit. But it's been great. People have been really showing up. I don't know how or why, but and it's been like the venue's been so easy to work with, and it's just, I don't know, it's very supportive. I've found to be a very supportive environment, especially coming from like New York comedy. I'm really having a really nice time.
Because as we will discover a little bit later, this is your first time at the Fringe.
Yes.
First time here doing the full show.
Absolutely.
And that show involves singing, hence why your voice is really important. But fingers crossed, it will hold in. Okay, with these conversations, we do a little bit of past, a little bit of present, a little bit of future. So I guess before we get into your Edinburgh show, maybe we should talk about your career in comedy so far. And I know you have a performance side where you're very much on stage, but you also write for other comedy shows. So, I mean, where did it begin? Did it begin with performing or writing?
It began with performing, I would say. I was doing a lot of, like, stand-up or, you know, alternative comedy at this theater called Brooklyn Comedy Collective in New York, which is the most amazing alt comedy theater, I think, in America. Yeah, I was performing a lot, obviously performing my own stuff, and then when...
And so that was stand-up back then?
That was like, it's like, we call it like not quite stand-up. So it was like a little bit like characters, a little bit multimedia stuff, some song stuff. I mean, it's still like, I always perform as like kind of like a heightened version of myself, I would say. So I was doing that, and then I got signed by like a manager and an agent, and they were sending me out for mostly acting stuff. And so that was what I ended up doing first. And I did like a bunch of little roles, you know, just like a scene or two there on like Law and Order and Marvelous Miss Maisel, all the shows that film in New York. And then I auditioned for this show called Dickinson on Apple TV.
Yes.
And I, as for like a larger role, and I got cast. And so then, yeah, I was acting on set for like 6 months. So acting was like, I had been doing that professionally, I guess, for like a couple of years. And then on Dickinson, actually, I got very close with the creator of the show because I was like on set all the time. And I think she saw sort of like a similar sensibility in me. And she knew that I was a comic and she knew that I was a writer too. And so she asked me to see like some of my material, and I sent her some, you know, pilots that I had written. And then she hired me to be in the writer's room. So then I was actually doing like full double duty for 3 years, acting for 6 months on Dickinson and then writing for 4 months in the writer's room.
Wow, so that's a... How did it change, I guess, given that you, I assume back when you were doing your comedy stuff in the New York Theater, you were writing and performing, albeit writing the stuff you were going to perform.
Yes, yes.
And then again, then you did all those acting gigs. And I guess once you were writing and performing on the same project, how did that impact, both sides, I guess, how did it impact your performance and how did it impact the writing?
Yeah, well, I was definitely busier, so I wasn't performing as much. I remember I would like be checking the clock to see like if I would get, you know, you know, off set or whatever, if we would wrap in time for me to go like do an open mic
in the evening,
and do like 5 minutes or whatever. But that didn't always happen. But I think, you know, I learned so much from being in that. Definitely as an actor, I mean, the comedic talent on that show, you know, Anna Baryshnikov, Jane Krakowski, it was like, I felt like I was like watching the masters. And so I felt like, especially because I had done so much performing on stage and learning how to like retrofit it for the screen, I just learned so much being on that set. And then for writing, the creator of Dickinson is like, she's just such an amazing writer, an amazing artist. And I felt like I really learned about writing from a place of like, it sounds kind of corny, but like passion. Like, don't just write the show that like has a sort of buzzy premise or like, you know, like you, or like some IP or book that you're like, I could adapt it. Like, write something that you really care about, the story you have to tell, you know, the themes that you want to explore. And that has been like such a good lesson in terms of the personal projects that I create for myself.
Yeah. I think obviously here in the UK, comedy TV shows or streaming shows or whatever, because they tend to be shorter in terms of output, so mm-hmm. a series will be 6 or 8 episodes, and they don't mm-hmm. tend to run for that many series. So often there is like 1 or 2 people writing them.
Yes.
And also, the American shows, we're very aware of the writer's room.
Yes.
Where you come together as a committee and you write. And I guess from British perspective, I think sometimes people are like, what happens in that room? what is the process?
Yeah, well, so it's funny because the writer's room I'm currently in is very different from the Dickinson writer's room. The Dickinson writer's room was like 5 people. We sat around, outlined episodes together, and then we would like split off and each sort of like write our own episode, come back, edit it. But we talked a lot. We talked all day. Like, sometimes we'd spend a whole day on just like funny things someone could say, or we'd spend a whole day on like, you know, I don't know, the order, was figuring out the order of the episodes, you know, if we were really stuck. So it was pretty like, in a nice way, like loose and collaborative. And then the Daily Show.
So yes, so yes. That's your current writer's room.
Sort of, because I'm on strike, but yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
As is everybody at the moment. But so strikes permitting. So then how did that opportunity come around?
So that came honestly out of nowhere. Like the late night shows hire new people pretty frequently because they're massive staffs and like there's a lot of turnover and whatever. And so I got a packet through my agent where, you know, you just have to write like a bunch of jokes that you would see on a late night show. And I had been doing sort of just randomly, like I'd been doing topical stand-up. I don't know, it was just like what was interesting to me at the time. You know, abortion, Roe v. Wade had been overturned, and I was just like kind of trying to talk about it on stage. And so I felt like really prepared for the packet. And so I just like, you know, took a lot of the stand-up bits that I had been doing and put them in there, and then had a couple of interviews, and then I got hired. So it was very like, I really wasn't expecting to get it. And it's like, I am an alternative comic.
Yeah.
So I don't consider myself like classic setup punchline
yeah.
comic. But I think maybe they liked that in my packet.
Well, I guess out of all the late night shows, it feels closest to
yes.
that side of comedy.
Yeah,
it?
It's definitely like there's room to be a little goofy
yeah.
and indulgent, and it's so smart, which I try to make my comedy like, you know, a little elevated. So yeah, but it really, I mean, I was so shocked. My parents were so surprised. It's like their favorite show, and they were like, you? And I was like, yeah, me. Yeah.
And you mentioned how the writer's room on Daily Show is very different. So
yes.
in what ways, I mean, obviously, the output is quite different, we can see that, but
yeah.
in what ways is it different in the room?
So it's super structured because we create a new show every night, and there's 16 of us. So basically every morning, it's just like the schedule is very clear. Every morning we like pitch a lot of jokes based on the stories, and then we pitch sort of like sketch ideas that we could do later that day, and then we watch the show. Like, we have to finish a draft of the show by like 1. Then we watch the show, then we edit it for what, you know, didn't go well or whatever, and then the show is done by 6. And it's just like, I feel like I'm like turning into like a machine.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like joke, 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 new idea, new idea, new idea. And the people I work with are like so fast. It's like I feel like we had a lot of time in the Dickinson room to really like explore, and the Daily Show, it's like, no, this has to be done.
Yes, and then once it's done,
yeah.
it's gone.
And then it's gone.
Never to be thought of again.
That's right. You can't go back and edit. If the joke didn't land, then the joke didn't land, and we have a new show the next day. Yeah.
And so throughout all of this, you were still doing your own performances, your own stand-up.
Yeah, when I did Dickinson for a second, I was like, oh, I can take a little break. I'm working, I have a job. And then once it ended, I kind of felt like, oh my God, I'm not totally sure what's next. And opportunities came along, but like, I really didn't know. And so then this time when I got The Daily Show, I was like, I'm not easing up on any of the things I have going for me. I'm gonna keep working on my show that I'll eventually take to Fringe, which is this show, and keep performing with my collective, Ladies Who Ranch, and just like pedal to the metal until someone makes me stop.
Do most of the writers on the show also have a performance side to what they do, or some of them just say they write for other people?
Yeah, it's like half and half. So I think a lot of them started performing. Some of them still do, but some of them were just like writers or even came from more of like a news background.
Yeah.
So yeah, half and half.
So you implied there that the Edinburgh show had sort of been on the to-do list for a while.
Yeah.
And so, why was it that at some point I'm going to do an hour and I'm going to take it to Edinburgh?
Yeah, so I was like, because I had been writing for other people for so long and acting in other people's things, I was kind of like, I want to take everything I've learned from that and really work on my, like, apply it all to this new thing. And I want to do, yeah. And I originally set out to do an hour of stand-up, and it turned into... like a, you know, one-woman musical about a girl who falls in love with her cousin. But, you know, that's like my version of my hour. And then I was kind of like always had Fringe in the back of my mind because there are so many great American comedians that I like really admire who have taken their shows to Fringe and loved it. And I talked to them about it. Emily Wilson, who was here last year, Alex Edelman, who shows on Broadway now, Kat Cohen. And so I just thought this is a really good place, especially for like a more theatrical hour, to work it out for 25 nights and see if people get excited about it and see if then we can bring it back to America and see if people are even more excited about it because it went to Fringe. So it was in the back of my mind for sure. And then it became a reality about half a year into doing the show.
And at what point, because you said originally it was just going to be a straight hour of stand-up.
Yeah.
So at what point is like, what this show needs is some songs.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. Even when I say straight hour of stand-up, I knew it was going to be musical.
You're going to have musical.
Yeah. Because I love to write music, and I think it's like, yeah, and normally I can sing and, you know, whatever. So so I knew that, but I thought it was going to be less of a narrative, less like beginning, middle, and end. But like, I don't know, I just thought of, there was a premise that really excited me, which was like a girl having to attend two funerals back to back and like having to reckon with sort of what she did at the first funeral.
At the second.
And you know, it's only semi-autobiographical. So I was like, I can't treat it like just straight stand-up because I don't want to like feel like I'm lying to people.
So the more theatrical the show is, the more it's like people are like, okay, this is
fiction. Yeah. Right. It's like I'm like telling the story I want to tell that like feels true to me, but it's not, I'm definitely playing a character.
Yeah. And in terms of the songs and the music, is that another passion of yours in writing music and writing songs?
Well, it's funny. If I had gone way back at the beginning of this interview and you're like, where did it all start? I wanted to be a musician for a long time.
Right, so it began with that.
Yes, I was like a classically trained pianist for like 18 years and then sort of got into comedy in college and like never looked back. But I love to write music, and I paid so much money for those piano lessons. So I have
put
to put
them
it to
good use.
Yeah, taught myself how to play the ukulele for this because I like to show that I can play like some different instruments, and the piano is like a big reveal at the end. And then wrote all the music and lyrics, and had a friend help me with some of the arrangements that I sing to. Yeah.
And so you decided Edinburgh was going to happen.
Yeah.
Was that before or after the strike had begun?
Oh, way before.
Way before.
Yeah.
So you knew you were going to be coming here.
Yeah, it kind of worked out. I was like, well, I'm going to have to tell my boss that I'm leaving for a month. And then it was like, never mind, there is no boss.
And, you know, in terms of, I mean, that's it. You've never been to the Fringe before. Yeah. And, I mean, it's famously a brilliant, inspiring nightmare of a place to come as a performer.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, what were you expecting? What, I mean, obviously you'd spoken to lots of people who've done The Fringe.
Yeah.
What had you heard about the performing at this festival?
Yeah, I definitely heard that it can like drive you crazy. And again, we're only 6 days in, so I'm feeling sane, but who's to say how long that will last? I heard it's really demanding. I heard, you know, it can be disheartening at the beginning, you know, playing to like 2 or 5, 10 people. I'm really lucky that that has not happened to me yet, but I don't know, maybe this week it will. Maybe the first week was like kind of a fluke. So I knew going in, I think I had really, not pessimistic, but like I was expecting it to be super, super, super difficult.
Yeah.
And it has been a little easier than that.
Yeah.
I've also talked to people who've had a lot of success from The Fringe. So like that, you know, I have high ambitions. Like I want to get great reviews and
yeah.
I hope that we've sold out twice, but I hope that like we start to sell out even more. But I'm also like, those are hopes, not expectations.
Yeah. I think the way your show evolved, I think you said this yourself, didn't you? Is what you have is a great Fringe show.
Yeah.
And maybe, I'm not saying if you'd done an hour of straight stand-up, it wouldn't have, you know, got as much people excited. But I think, you know, by being a bit different and not just another joke punchline show, that does resonate well with Fringe audiences are picking things where they're not necessarily that certain what they're going to
see. Right.
Something like that with a bit of narrative, a bit of novelty, I think does stand out.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see because I had like an awful show in New York, like right before I came here with this show. And I was feeling really self-conscious about how theatrical it was. And I was like, oh no, like people don't know you're supposed to laugh at it. Like maybe I'm like being too much of an actor on stage. And I was like, should I like try to adjust it to make it feel more like a traditional stand-up special? And then coming here, it was like, no, like follow those instincts from the beginning and just like lean into it. And I'm hoping I can like take, some of that confidence back with me to America and be like, no,
and prove
you guys
to them they were wrong.
Exactly. I was like, the people here loved it. So, but yeah, it's been really very, very cool. You know.
So let's look to the future. I mean, is that sort of the future of this show? So you mentioned, you know, part of your hope is to get a bit of buzz, get a bit of, you know, reviews and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so would you like to then be performing this elsewhere in the world, back home and beyond?
Yeah, so we've only done it. Now we've done it in New York, LA, and Edinburgh. I'm hoping to take it to London for some point. I'm hoping to take it around the US a little bit. And then I would love to get like a run of it, you know, at a cool theater in New York. And then I would love to make it a movie. So I'm having like a couple of conversations about that, but obviously that also had to be stopped because of the strike.
And that presumably would involve more people than just you.
I think so. I think there is like a weird lo-fi version where like I Orphan Black it and I play like every like character in like weird wigs. But ideally, no, it would be like full production musical. And I think it would work really well. And I have a draft of that screenplay, but you know, I'm going to keep working on it depending on how the show changes while I'm here. Those are the dreams. And if none of that works out, then I'll just move on to my next project. But I got some dreams.
Let's assume the studios figure this out.
Yeah.
And they sort out the streaming and the AI and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And the strike's finished. I mean, is obviously Daily Show, it's quite hard to know where to go beyond The Daily Show in that sort of area.
I know.
Such a good show.
I know.
But I mean, in terms of the future, that split between writing and performing, do you have a particular preference of where it goes? Or do you like doing a bit of both and having the balance?
I love doing both. I think just being an actor is really hard. It feels like your future is always in someone else's hands. So it's nice to be a writer and be able to generate opportunities for yourself. So my dream is, to make stuff that I can be in. And I mean, there are opportunities like that at The Daily Show where, you know, if you're on camera, you're also writing for yourself. So maybe that is in my future, or maybe The Daily Show just lets me do whatever I want and then come back to write because I really do love the job and I think I'd like to be there for a long time, which I keep saying to everybody. So yeah.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up there, but we should do the plugging. So first of all, with the Edinburgh Show, venue, time slot.
Okay, great. It's called Sophie Sucks Face. It's at Underbelly, Bristow Square, Dexter Hall, 10:15 p.m. every single night.
And where can people find you online?
Oh, great. And you can find me online on Twitter, on Instagram. Don't look for me on TikTok because I don't post anything there. I just lurk. But Instagram is String Cheese Zucker, but also I think if you type in Sophie Zucker, it'll come up. And then Twitter is also Sophie R. Zucker. If you type in Sophie Zucker, it'll
come up. That's
yes.
brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.